welcome. And it's an absolute pleasure to have you at the first podcast summarizing the key messages from the recent webinar, Evolving Therapeutic Strategies for Psoriatic Diseases. Not all IL-23s are created similar. Now, my name is Ian McInnes. I'm a rheumatologist based up in Glasgow, and I'm delighted to be joined by Associate Professor Laura Coates from the Nuffield Department of Orthopaedics, Rheumatology and Musculoskeletal Sciences at the University of Oxford. Laura.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Looking all ready to face the spring here in the United Kingdom. So you've got your scarf, gloves and woolly coats ready to go. And I don't know where you are listening to this podcast. Maybe you're in the same situation. That would be the Southern Hemisphere, but there we go. So we're going to give you a few highlights, summary of the content delivered in a webinar which accompanies this podcast. The webinar was recorded on 30th April 2024, chaired by myself, but the real core content came from Professor Coates, Richland and Mees. And what a rare treat it was to be present. Three fantastic summaries of burden of disease, pathophysiology underpinning, and then real world evidence, gradually honing in on the biology of IL-23 and why inhibition of IL-23 might be a useful part of our therapeutic armamentarium. So if you want to access the full on-demand webinar and you're already desperate to do that, but don't leave, listen to the podcast first, then head across to www.imidforum.com. That's www.imidforum, all one word, .com, and you watch it for free. I can't offer you a better deal than that. And coming from a Scot, let me tell you, that's a big deal. So the first webinar was entitled The Burden of Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis. It was delivered by Laura. And what I'm going to suggest maybe, Laura, is you might want to summarize the key elements that you brought about. And what I can tell you as part of your audience was a really beautiful discussion. Over to you.
Yeah, sure. So we talked really about the burden of psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis to kind of introduce the topic and think about how these diseases impact on our patients living with them. So we covered issues around disease heterogeneity. So obviously, we see massive variation in patients with PSA affecting different domains, different tissues of the body. And that's something that we all deal with day to day in clinic, and something that really helps us when we're selecting therapy and planning therapy to know what we should be targeting, and the treatment that we would offer somebody with axial disease and enthesitis, for example, might be quite different to somebody with peripheral arthritis and mild skin disease. So really thinking about how that influences our treatment, but also thinking about how those different domains influence on the patients. So some very nice data from the Dutch registry, which shows that whether you have monoarthritis, oligoarthritis or polyarthritis, there's still a big impact on quality of life. And actually, that's not particularly higher in the polyarthritis compared to those with fewer joints involved. So trying to really bust that myth that oligoarthritis is a milder form of disease and maybe doesn't need as much treatment. And then we talked a lot about the impact of comorbidities and related conditions. So obviously IBD and uveitis, which we see as being related to spondyloarthritis, and again is relevant just like the domains of disease, because it's going to help us either choose a therapy because it's going to be beneficial, or potentially avoid a therapy if it may make things worse. And then really the broader comorbidities, which to be fair, I think are much more common, much more prevalent than seeing the related conditions, and maybe are not directly related to how we choose our biologics. But there's definitely big issues that we need to address. So thinking about addressing depression to improve quality of life, to support patients with adherence to therapy, as well as managing with their chronic condition. Thinking about controlling inflammation to try and help with metabolic syndrome risk and cardiovascular events. And we talked quite a bit around obesity, and again in the discussions as well, about how obesity may impact on our risk of disease, but also the impact of the disease and the chance of achieving good outcomes with treatment. So addressing this alongside treating inflammation is important. And really trying to bring that back to the clinic to think about how we choose the drugs that we have. We've got a very big selection now, which is a nice problem to have, but trying to select those in clinics so that we get the right drug for the right person.
A fantastic summary, Laura, and thanks for bringing it down into that really digestible synthesis. Yeah, so look, there's so many elements here we could explore together. I want to start, though, with the concept of multiple domains, and we'll touch on this just in a moment when we think about what Chris Richland was saying in terms of the underlying physiology. But it strikes me now that when you or I see a patient in clinic, we have a great big clue as to which direction of travel we should be taking therapeutically simply by looking at the pattern of disease our patient presents. I actually asked you this in the webinar, but I'd love just to go back. So I thought your answer was just beautifully put. So, you know, for us practicing clinicians, in a nutshell, how do we use the pattern of disease to guide MOA decisions?
So I think it's really thinking about things beyond the joints. For joints, we see very similar outcomes. Where we have got head-to-head studies, and there aren't many, they've shown similar joint outcomes with the different MOAs. So joints, actually, despite us being rheumatologists, are probably the least important in that decision. It's thinking about the other domains. So I think my first key domain would be axial disease, because that's going to decide whether we use conventional drugs or whether we go straight to biologics. So that's kind of the first decision point that we need to make. And then beyond that, it's thinking about skin disease, where obviously the dermatologists have been spoilt with many trials showing testing head-to-head and showing benefit of newer mode of action over older mode of action as we've moved through. So we've got really powerful head-to-head data in psoriasis, which helps us to make a decision. And for a lot of our patients, that may not be a big deal. The psoriasis may be mild. But remember that for a lot of our patients, even if we think the psoriasis is mild, if it's somewhere visible, even if their PASI is well below 10, it may still be a big issue for them. And so targeting, treating that skin disease and trying to get them clear may be a really important thing for them. And then beyond that, it's those related conditions and comorbidities. So are there reasons why you can't use particular drugs or would avoid particular mode of action? Or hopefully, are there reasons where actually that mode of action might treat more than one disease? If you've got inflammatory bowel disease, psoriasis and PSA, potentially you could treat it all with one drug and really make the patient's day.
I love that last concept. I mean, the truth is we quite often end up in the area of complex mixtures of medicines that we use. And one of those medicines, by the way, is methotrexate. And I wanted just to touch on that very briefly. You showed in the webinar some really interesting and for me quite worrying data about the burden that falls on liver and MASLD. I'm getting used to the new name for what used to be called NAFLD. You heard it here first. Well, probably not. It was a change of name announced around the turn of the year. But this is metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. It really trips off the tongue. So MASLD it is. And you know, I'm going to ask you a time-honored question here, Laura. Are we relaxed about the kind of the background methotrexate that so often seems to accompany our interventions with other immune targeted therapeutics?
Yeah, so I think it is a difficult balance. And I think there's more to know about liver disease. What we do know is that liver function tests are not the whole story. You can have very normal liver function tests or slightly deranged liver function tests hiding quite significant issues. And vice versa, sometimes you get very high peaks in liver function tests that come back down quickly. And actually, the liver is not particularly affected in the long term. So I think we really need more data. Obviously, the regular use of FibroScans in clinics with the liver team is definitely giving us more information and I think more useful information than an LFT or trying to do a liver biopsy. It's giving us a better idea of the risk facing those patients and a non-invasive way of monitoring liver disease over time. So in my patients who have consistently raised liver tests or worrying liver tests, particularly where we want to use methotrexate or leflunomide or even a combination, then we're asking hepatology to keep an eye on the FibroScan and really give us a steer. Sometimes we get very low risk and everybody's happy, and including the patients. Sometimes we're surprised by higher risk scans, even in patients who may not be that overweight.
No, thank you. And just before we leave this section on the burden of psoriatic disease, I also want just to call out the metabolic syndrome, obesity, and cardiovascular risk. You beautifully described that in the webinar. And the upshot is that patients with psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, are more likely to have features of metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular risk factors. And I've heard it said at meetings around the world, well, I'm a rheumatologist, that's not my problem. And I have to say, I just disagree with that. I usually try and find middle ground, but I simply disagree. This seems to me like an intrinsic part of the condition. And it therefore feels that as the physician controlling or doing one's best to control disease activity, it should be pretty intrinsic in our practice. What are your views?
I think it's always difficult, isn't it? We're juggling a lot. We're often under pressure in clinic, don't have enough time. And it's easy, I think, for those things to slip, where you're dealing with the kind of primary focus of the joints or the axial disease, and it's easy for that to get lost. It's a massive burden for our patients who come back, you know, post-MI, post-stroke, or don't come back post these things. So I think it's a big thing to address. I don't think as rheumatologists, we're always the best person to do all of it. But I think coordinating care and raising awareness with our primary care colleagues is key. I don't know the best data on different antihypertensives or which statin's currently the cheapest and is the choice for the ICB locally. You know, those things are not necessarily my level of expertise, but I think if we can point out where we see issues that should be addressed, think about screening for metabolic syndrome and really flagging to GPs that in patients with psoriatic disease, it's maybe more of an issue than normal, and that we do see this higher risk.
Oh, fantastic. I think that's grand. I think the critical piece to take home learning is we need to make sure that work's being done. And that will improve outcomes for our patients. That's been demonstrated in numerous studies. Well, look, let's move on. The second part of the webinar series was a short seminar given by Professor Chris Richland in Rochester, New York, United States. It's my unenviable task to try and summarize what Chris said. He did it far more beautifully than I'll ever manage. But his fundamental thesis was that with the range of modes of action that we now have available to treat people with psoriatic arthritis and, for that matter, psoriasis, it behoves us to start to understand what are those underlying mechanisms that underpin the either common across different tissue domains or potentially those that are more uniquely expressed within that. And so in his opening remarks, he's described the different domains and the different potential pathways. And a particularly useful model, which I must say I quite like, is a conversation that thinks about different initiators of disease. That could be mechanoinflammation. It could be, and think of mechanoinflammation is not that subtle a concept. You know, think about any area where tissue is exposed to high mechanical load. So that would be brushing your hair. It would be flexural regions. It would be the allocecal junction, the bowel. It would be the enthesis. And so biomechanical factors have been proposed as initiators of disease. So too, based on what we've just been discussing, Laura, is the underlying burden of adiposity. Adipose tissue is very inflammatory. And it might simply be that it raises the temperature, the inflammatory temperature in the patient, that allows the onset of a disease on other genetic or other environmentally induced factors. Then there's the long-standing contention that something's going on in the gut. Well, there's pretty good evidence of that in some of our patients because, you know, a proportion of people with psoriatic spectrum disease will indeed have bona fide inflammatory bowel disease. And at the subclinical level, the Belgian studies that have used endoscopy to look at the GI mucosa, it actually looks abnormal in quite a significant proportion of our patients. And that is an initiating sequence of events. And there will be upstream cytokine pathways dominated by interleukin 23. That in turn drives a series of downstream events, so-called enhancer cytokines, of which IL-17A and IL-17F are probably amongst the most important. And I say that because when you add IL-17A or IL-17F in combination with other cytokines to in vitro assays, for example, to test their immunologic stimulatory capability, what you find is that they act synergistically with TNF, with IL-1, with IL-6. In other words, IL-17A and IL-17F are amplifying, enhancing cytokines. And then eventually we get to the foot soldiers, TNF and other molecules like it, which are actually driving effector responses alongside the enhancing response of the IL-17 superfamily. So what Professor Richland beautifully described is almost a hierarchy, an onion skin effect of different contributions of cytokines in the psoriatic spectrum. He then went on and talked about some really fascinating data, starting to dissect out the different cells that can operate across different tissues. For example, did you know that cytokines, particularly the IL-17 superfamily, but I would actually throw in here IL-1 and TNF and IL-6 for honorable mention, although we don't tend to talk about it a lot in psoriatic spectrum disease because the 6 receptor inhibitors didn't do a lot in our clinical trials. But IL-6 is in the body of these patients and it's bioactive and it's one of the key communicators between the immune system, the metabolic system. IL-6 is almost a circulating hormone-like cytokine when thought about in that context. But remember that immune cells, through the release of soluble cytokines, regulate the way white adipocytes, brown adipocytes, myocytes, fibroblasts, epithelial cells, hepatocytes, neurons, think tissue, think target tissue, think effect of the immune system. And that's just an evolutionary imperative, isn't it? We know that the immune system has to talk to the rest of the body and vice versa. And Chris did a beautiful job in describing that. And the last thing that I want to highlight in his discussion was the role that IL-23 has on some quite specific features in psoriatic skin. And the IL-23 being that regulator has quite broad effects, but particularly on a subset of T cells called resident memory T cells, which they do what the label says they do. They're retained in tissue and they have memory of what they've seen before, which in the context of chronic immune disease means they're likely to be perpetuating cells. And IL-23 seems to be really, really important. And when we look at clinical studies in which IL-23 has been given to patients and biopsies have been taken before and after the administration of drug, we see diminution of the number of these resident memory T cells. Now, the long-term clinical significance of this is yet to be fully unraveled, but it's provocative, isn't it? That a regulatory cytokine responsible for the maintenance of a pretty pivotal part of the immune system is when it is given to patients, those cells are reduced in number and tissue residency. So more work to be done in that area, but a really intriguing potential differentiating role of the different modes of action here when we start to think about what IL-23 inhibitor, 17A or dual AF inhibitor or TNF inhibitor might do. And finally, a comment on the IL-23 inhibitors themselves. And this is a very interesting phenomenon. It's been shown in vitro at the moment. IL-23 inhibitors, we could think of guselkumab, risankizumab, tildrakizumab. Just what you may not be aware of is that, say, guselkumab and risankizumab are subtly different. And they're subtly different because their Fc component of the antibody is actually modified so that guselkumab binds the Fc receptor in a macrophage, risankizumab doesn't. Now, it turns out, at least in vitro, that is quite important in changing the way IL-23 is cleared out of the system. And the inhibitory potential for guselkumab. Now, we've not yet seen that come through in terms of clinical relevance, but it may well be that that clinical relevance will take some time to emerge. Watch this space. But it is interesting to think that different IL-23 inhibitors actually may have subtly different modes of action in the target tissue. Now, it would enthuse me greatly to offer these immunologic thoughts to Professor Coates. And Laura, any immediate response to that before we talk about the real world data? But it was a beautiful lecture that Chris gave. I don't know if there's anything you want to highlight in what you heard.
I think it's just how we link that into clinical response. So as you said, some of the IL-23s are different. As of yet, we haven't seen that play out in terms of clinical difference. But I think if you look between the mode of actions, understanding the basics of that immunology to someone who's not a diehard immunologist is relevant to that clinical decision making. It's thinking about which tissues you're targeting, why we might see differences in the spine, for example, with IL-23, with AxSpA, and with axial PSA, and thinking about how those different drugs work in combination and how you therefore select them. So I think it's that link between the kind of clinical relevance and the differences in those mode of actions that's really key.
Yeah, that's spot on. And let's remember, we're still early days in the introduction of 23 inhibition in patients. So, I think it would be really important for people listening to this podcast just to have at the back of their mind, they need to look out for how these different 23 inhibitors play out in clinic. Be aware that there are subtle differences in the way in which they're going to work in the target tissue. But of course, the ultimate arbiter here is going to be what happens in the clinic. And I think, Laura, you were going to just very briefly summarize what Philip Mees so beautifully described to us in terms of real world data. And here we really were focusing now on the IL-23 pathway and guselkumab in particular. Maybe Laura, over to you for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, there've been published phase 3 trials of all the IL-23 inhibitors in development that we've seen in terms of licensing. But we know there's still limitations in that level of data. We have slightly odd, unusual patients that go into clinical trials. They're not reflective of our full normal population. So I think having some data from real world registries is really insightful as well to understand how these are being used and how people do when they're receiving these therapies. Obviously, with a bit of a caveat that it's likely that a lot of the patients getting these drugs will have experienced a drug before. Whenever you bring a new drug in, that tends to be offered to patients who failed a therapy, are struggling, and maybe need a new option. So often it gets tested in sort of trickier customers to start with. So Philip presented kind of two key bits of data. So one from the core Evitas registry, which he's obviously heavily involved in leading on the psoriatic side. So this is a large US registry collecting data, quite detailed data, looking at different domains in patients receiving different therapies. And they looked at around 100 patients who'd been treated with guselkumab in the wild, quite typical PSA patients from clinic. So a lot of them had comorbidities and had other issues, which maybe would have meant they wouldn't have gone into a clinical trial. Most of them had quite established disease, so a number of years since their diagnosis, and a lot obviously with psoriasis as well. And I think that data really nicely shows the response in different elements of disease. So DAPSA scores, looking at joint outcomes, pain scores, and so impact of the patient, and obviously skin, where we know we see very good outcomes with IL-23. And also showed some very nice data looking at the proportions of people achieving different targets. So a very high number, more than half, achieving a body surface area of less than 3%, and about 20% achieving MDA and VLDA. So a good target for therapy, which is definitely useful to talk with patients about likely outcomes. And showing improvements across patient-reported outcomes, so pain scores, fatigue scores, and patient globals. And then the other kind of group of data that he showed was 12-month data looking at outcomes, but this time from claims data. So obviously with this, you get a lot less detail. You don't get joint counts and detailed information about the patients, but you get big numbers of patients who are receiving IL 17, IL 23, and TNF, in real world practice, and looking at claims data from insurance companies. So they looked at patients changing therapy, they looked at diagnosing PSA, a diagnosis of PSA before starting therapy, and then they compared persistence, which is all you can easily get from claims data. Did people keep taking that drug for patients with a diagnosis of PSA? And what that showed quite nicely over the 12-month period is that persistence was significantly higher with guselkumab compared to an IL-17A inhibitor, and also with guselkumab compared to a TNF inhibitor. So better persistence over that year. And obviously for a chronic disease, this is a big problem for us. We don't want something that just works in a short outcome. We need to get data in terms of long-term outcomes and long-term persistence on therapies. That's really important to patients. They don't want a drug to make them better and then to lose that response. That's something that they worry about a lot. So I think that's key, but I think there's probably more for us to learn from longer term registry data about whether methotrexate impacts on that, whether other patient characteristics impact on that, and making sure that we're trying as much as possible to compare like with like in terms of lines of therapy.
Yeah, that's a wonderful summary. Thank you of what was a really helpful and comprehensive talk from Philip. Yeah, so again, focus down on IL-23 inhibition here. The persistence data are fascinating. Now, during the webinar, we talked about the potential risk of channeling bias here of, you know, certain patients end up on a certain MOA because there's a gestalt or some other influencing factor. I'm with you here, Laura. I think we just need longer term data. We need to just see how these different modes of action play out. At least in theory, as we link our three presentations together, going after a regulatory cytokine like IL-23, it kind of makes sense because you're working upstream, you're just gently quietening down the whole inflammatory lesion. And that perpetuating driving factor has been quiescent. But I'd love to see more data before I become fully wedded to that as fact. I guess the other thing that, as far as I know, is still a bit of an unknown, Laura, but just circling back to the beginning, metabolic disease, liver function, just keeping our eyes wide open here on what the IL-23 inhibitors are going to offer in that space.
Yeah, and I think that's where more real-world registry data helps. But obviously, there's a fair number of patients with blood pressure and diabetes and obesity in the trials. These are not purely healthy people. So I think you do get some idea. And generally speaking, the safety has been very reassuring. You know, we've seen relatively low issues with infections and with liver abnormalities. I guess, you know, as we discussed much earlier with methotrexate, the question is whether methotrexate shows any benefit here in co-prescription or whether it's just not required. And that would clearly reduce risk for our patients long term.
No, absolutely. And those are data that we're expecting to see very soon indeed. No, great point, Laura. You know, unfortunately, I think we're out of time and we've covered a huge amount of ground. We've thought a little bit about the burden of disease, we've thought about the mechanisms of disease, and we've now been able to drill down on the potential offering that we have in IL-23 inhibition, and particularly we've focused on guselkumab today, the potential that this mode of action has to improve outcomes in our patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. Laura, what a joy to spend time with you. I have, as I always do, learn from you. Your measured and thoughtful approach is hugely appreciated. Really appreciate you taking the time to join me for the conversation today. And of course, it's always a pleasure for us to have the colleagues like Philip Mees and Chris Richland to work with in terms of the webinar. I don't know if you have any thoughts you want to share before we close.
Yeah, no, I think it's been a really nice session to think through logically, like you say, and to link what we know from clinical data to the basic science. And I think that's hopefully helpful to practicing clinicians too.
No, absolutely. And finally, a warm thanks to you for listening to our podcast. I hope you found the highlight summary useful, and make sure to keep an eye out for the next installment in this webinar series coming later this year. In the meantime, remember to visit www.imedforum.com to access content on inflammatory diseases. Thanks ever so much for your attention. We hope you found this useful, and I wish you well. Thanks ever so much.